is a community guide presentation, and it is also formed the main basis for the Community Primitive Services Task Force to make a recommendation. So I will start my presentation with a little context, with some information on the community guide and the task force. And I would also like to recognize Teresa Seip, who is the chief coordinating scientist on this project. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here at APHA this year. So this is our disclaimer. The findings and conclusions are of those of the authors and the task force, but do not necessarily reflect those of the CDC, and we have no financial disclosures. So before we get into the actual review, so what is a community guide? We are a branch at the CDC, it is State of the Science Systematic Reviews, the main aim of which is to look at the evidence and effectiveness of various community-based public health interventions. We also have an economics team that looks at the economic benefits from these interventions. And one of the other main things that we do is to highlight critical research gaps that might not be in the evidence. These reviews are conducted by expert teams. So the guide is filled with people who have expertise in systematic review methodology. We do reviews across various topics, and these reviews form the basis for evidence-based recommendations by the Community Preventive Services Task Force that I'll talk about in the next slide. And the recommendations cover effective programs and policies for communities, work sites, schools, healthcare systems, etc. And on slide four, this is the Community Preventive Services Task Force, which is a non-federal independent body, rotating body, which is the members of which are appointed by the CDC director after a rigorous nomination process. They serve without payment for limited terms. The CDC provides scientific, technical, and admin support for them, which is the community guide mainly. And so having said that, let us now move to the conceptual approach to reviews of the guide. So if you think of an intervention, the main thing that we need to look at or examine through our systematic evidence-based reviews is to see, one, is the intervention effective across the body of evidence in improving outcomes, which will ultimately lead to reduced morbidity and mortality. We also look at what are the additional benefits from these interventions, what are the potential harms that might be identified through the interventions, what are the barriers to implementation of the interventions, and like I said before, we also do economic evaluations because increasingly that is becoming the most important question from various interventions. And over the last 2 years, we've made great efforts to collect applicability information on external validity. So people want to know if this recommendation is generalizable to their specific population, to their specific context. So we do that as well. And we highlight research gaps for each of our reviews. So now that we've looked at the conceptual framework for approaching reviews of the guide, slide six, this is the mental health coordination team. So for each of our topics, we put together a team. We have the guide staff on the team, who are experts in systematic reviews. And then we bring in experts, subject matter experts for that specific topic, because now we're talking about depression. These are all professionals from mental health and mental illness. We have a task force member on the team. We also have liaisons to the task force who work with the task force in developing recommendations and disseminating these recommendations. Kevin Hennessy from SAMHSA was a liaison member on this team. We also have CDC and non-CDC partners. The idea is to get various professionals from various backgrounds and different perspectives so that the quality of the product and the utility of the product is that much greater. The slide seven is just a little background on depression. Depression affects 15 million Americans every year. There is a large unmet need for mental health services in the United States. Primary care remains the typical point of entry and the typical continuation of care for depression in the U.S. $52 billion U.S. dollars was a productivity cost that was estimated a few years ago. I'm sure it's more now. And because of all this, there have been increasing efforts to integrate care at the primary care level for depression. So slide eight is the chronic care model, which is the central theme of this whole session. We have the community aspect on the left, where we're trying to develop resources and policies so that patients may be activated to participate in more self-management activities and be more informed about their condition and what they can do. At the same time, you want to organize healthcare so that there's more decision support, there's more information systems, and there's more redesign of the delivery system so that you get this coordinated, well-informed practice teams that work together with the informed patient and then that should improve outcomes. And because this is the chronic care model, you want this to sustain because they will need care for a long time. So slide 9, maybe a decade ago, the chronic care model was adopted specifically for depression at the primary care level, and this was called the collaborative care model. The two core components that was described in the collaborative care model by Wayne Caton and colleagues was one is using allied health professionals as case managers, and they would work with the primary care providers, and they would principally provide education to patients on depression. They would follow up with patients. They would track their outcomes. They would track their response to treatment. They would track their treatment adherence. They would also make sure that patients got additional visits if needed with the primary care provider or mental health specialist. The second component was having a mental health specialist, a psychiatrist or a psychologist, who would provide caseload supervision to the primary care provider and the case manager, and they would bring that decision support component into the model. So slide 10, this is, so taking all that into account, our team came up with this is what was our official definition for collaborative care for this review. And I read, collaborative care for depressive disorders is a complex healthcare systems level intervention in which depression care is coordinated by linking primary care providers, patients, and mental health specialists through case managers. So primary care providers receive case management support in addition to consultation and decision support from mental health specialists. And this level of collaboration is designed to achieve improved screening and diagnosis of depressive disorders, improved support for active client and patient involvement in their own care, and improved concordance with evidence-based guidelines for management of depressive disorders. So slide 11, so typically collaborative care interventions have the following components. This is what we found from the review: patient education, support for self-care, provider education, provider feedback mechanisms, oversight for providers, and the emphasis on being concordant with evidence-based guidelines. And often we found, sometimes we found that these elements are often supported by technology-enabled resources like electronic medical records, telephone contact systems, and provider reminder mechanisms. So in a typical guide review on slide 12, we develop an analytic framework. So all the concepts that we have, we diagrammatically represent it as a framework so that we can show how we hypothesize the intervention to work. So we have collaborative care intervention circle at the top, and that organizes providers. The providers are in the dotted box at the bottom, primary care providers, case managers, and mental health specialists. So this reorganizes their arrangement to form that collaboration that you can see as a second dotted box at the bottom, the primary care provider, the case manager, the mental health specialist, and the patient is in the middle of all that, interacting with all three of them. So this enhances collaboration of providers and improves support for client or patient involvement in their own care. Both of this leads to improved depression care through concordance with evidence-based guidelines, better collaboration, better case management, better self-care. It also leads to improved screening and diagnosis because providers would use better screening tools. They would spend more time screening patients who present with depressive symptoms rather than just referring them or prescribing antidepressants. And should ultimately lead to these big outcomes that you have in the red boxes, increasing the proportion of population screened and diagnosed for depression, increased adherence to treatment, improvement in depression symptoms, improved response to treatment, remission, recovery, and ultimately improved quality of life and functional status. So slide 13, let me just give you a couple of examples really quickly so that you get a better idea. So this is an example from the Pathways trial, Simon and colleagues, 2007. This was in 9 primary care clinics in Washington and Idaho. So the population here was clients who had depression, diagnosed with depression, and also had comorbid diabetes. In this case, the case manager was a nurse, the primary care provider was a physician, and the mental health specialist was a psychiatrist or a psychologist. They had both options in this model. The physician prescribed medications. They were the central point of care. The case manager followed up in person or via telephone every 2 weeks. This was integrated into the model. So no matter what happened, they would contact the patient every 2 weeks. And as necessary, the mental health specialist would provide supervision and consultation. So this just is an example to better understand how the model works. And this is the second example, and it doesn't have to be in the healthcare setting. It can be in the worksite setting. This is a very large study, Wang et al., where they took 16 very diverse national-level organizations, airlines, banking offices, manufacturing industry, even some governmental organizations. And the idea was to reach out to employees with depression, and some of them had not even were not even in care yet. So the case manager would reach out to them, make sure or encourage them to start receiving care. And once they start receiving care, they would touch base with the primary care provider regularly and also touch base with the patients. So there's various ways and various degrees of the collaborative care model, and you can use it in various settings, is what we found. So these are our research questions. The main thing, of course, is, you know, is collaborative care effective? And if it is, how effective is it in managing depression or improving the management of depression in the community and by improving all those outcomes that I already talked about? And our second research question was to look at the subgroup analysis sort of to see if the effectiveness of collaborative care was different by various demographic variables. Did it work better for women than for men? Did it work better for this race versus that race? And socioeconomic status, the organization setting. And this is typical of what we do at the guide. We try to look at this, and this kind of tries to answer our applicability question and generalizability question that I was referring to earlier. So slide 16, the next step, the systematic review is, of course, to do the search. So we did a systematic search of the literature, and we initially started with 8,000 odd potentially relevant articles from our search. And after we screened them, we had another 1,000 that we looked at full text. And finally, we saw 226 papers, published papers, that did some sort of evaluation of this intervention. So then we knew this was going to be a very active area of research. We're going to find a lot of studies. Out of those 226, we found a number of them were reviews themselves, just like we were trying to do, systematic reviews, and some were just narrative reviews. People had just talked about examples, but not done a systematic review. And then we found 70 intervention studies, so that was a huge review. Of the reviews that we found, I just want to spend the next slide talking about was Barr and Gilbody. It was two reviews. I mean, it was the same review, but two papers, a meta-analysis and a meta-regression, which was done by the same group of researchers in England. So what are the main findings from the Barr and Gilbody review? They've done a search up to the year 2004, and they already identified 37 RCTs of collaborative care models. And they found that it worked really well to reduce depression symptoms at 6 months, and they even had evidence that from some of their studies that had followed it up to 5 years, they found good results. And then they further did a meta-regression. So when you do a meta-regression, you're essentially trying to see what are the elements within the collaborative care model that are more influential than others. And they found that systematic identification of patients, so the screening aspect, a professional background of staff, and the specialist supervision were key elements which made the difference with this collaborative care model. So because we found this review, the Barr and Gilbody review, so this was our review plan, was to update from the Barr and Gilbody review. And the task force always encourages the consideration of high-quality systematic reviews. And when our team looked at it, the mental health experts, it was a very similar conceptualization to what we had. The outcomes were similar. Of course, we had more outcomes. And it was 5 years old in an area of very active research. So we are finding 30-plus studies even after Barr and Gilbody. And so our plan was to take the Barr and Gilbody results up to 2004, and then we would update from 2004 onwards to 2009 when we did the lit search. So slide 19, this is the number of studies we had from 2004, not including the Barr and Gilbody studies, to 2009, and this is a typical body of evidence of the guide. Now, we have two systems of classification of studies. One is the second, third, and fourth column is the suitability of design. That is, by study design, we have greatest, moderate, and least. So for example, a randomized controlled trial would be classified as greatest, just a cross-sectional study would be least. We also have a quality of execution system where we assess studies for how they actually executed the studies. All studies are not designed equal. You might have a randomized controlled trial where they've taken care of all kinds of bias, and you might have another randomized controlled trial where there's all kinds of problems with the way they implemented it. So we assign limitations, and two people do this for every paper that we review. And so if a study has no limitations or just one limitation, it's a good, what we call a good study, and 2 to 4 is fair. And then greater than 5 is limited. The limited ones we typically don't include in the analysis. So we had 32 qualified studies with 39 study arms, because some studies are more than one. All right, so this is just the forest plot for the depression symptoms outcomes. We did this for every one of our outcomes, but I'll just show this one today. So as you can see, the squares, each diagram is an individual study, and anything to the right of zero is in the positive direction. And the diamond at the bottom is kind of like the overall effect estimate from all the studies, considering their sample size and what they bring to the study. So I won't go into the details, but we found a standardized mean difference of 0.34 and was statistically significant. And I'll translate that in the, hope to translate that in the next slide. So this is from all our outcomes. We have the standardized mean difference and the odds ratios, and all of them were statistically significant compared to usual care. So when assessing the effect, we look for clinical significance of the effect size and also public health benefit. And looking at these numbers, and our team of mental health experts determined that these were meaningful and had a meaningful public health benefit, and the task was agreed. The quality of life was small, but it was still in the favorable direction. And we compared our findings to Barr and Gilbody. We found that kind of like the effect size was sustained. It was going in the same direction that they had. So that kind of confirmed what they had with what we found. We also found that it was applicable to most settings. It also increased productivity in the worksite study that we talked about, increased adherence to cancer treatment in one of the studies, no potential harms. The biggest barrier was, of course, institutional resistance. This is an organizational level intervention. You need to make a lot of changes to implement it. So that is always a problem. Recruitment and retention of clients, considering this is a mental illness, it's always a challenge, and access and insurance coverage. We also did an economic evaluation. I won't go into the details. Our economics team looked at it, and the weight of the economic evidence indicated that collaborative care provided good economic value. So this is the cost effectiveness and cost benefits. And just to summarize, so this is a team-based, multi-component intervention, temporary depression care. It coordinates care for depression at the primary care level. It uses case managers, primary care providers, mental health specialists working together, activates the patient. It's found to robustly improve a range of depression-related outcomes, but it requires healthcare system-level organizational change, applicable to a wide variety of populations and settings, and found to be of good economic value. And slide 26 is actually the official task force findings. If you go to our website, you'll see this language. This is the official language that the task force put out recommending this intervention. The main gap was better reporting of results by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status in adolescents would have been helpful. But that's kind of like the next steps of research from this field. Although we are seeing more collaborative care models for comorbid conditions like depression and hypertension in recent publications. Thank you. Please visit our website for all our task force recommendations.